Good day. Today is Tuesday, 4th November 2025. And let me again begin this program by reminding you to press the like button. If once having listened to the program or that part of the program that you want to listen to, you liked what you've heard and want to indicate that fact. Now, let's proceed with the topics under discussion. And again, I'm going to start with the main geopolitical topic. It continues to be that, in my opinion, which is the conflict in Ukraine. Now, a couple of days ago, I did a program in which I discussed a truly bizarre set of statements made by the president of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky, at a meeting in Kiev, despite or perhaps in consequence of the increasing crisis the Ukrainian army is facing on the battlefields. Well, astonishingly, in his very latest comments, President Zelensky went even beyond those comments. The comments that he made this time struck me as so astonishing, so strange, that, to say it quickly, I'm starting to doubt whether indeed, despite comments I've made recently about the stability of the government in Kiev, whether it is going to be possible for him to remain president of Ukraine for very much longer, because they suggest to me a complete lack of understanding or comprehension of the realities of the situation on the ground. So President Zelensky said that the situation in Kupiansk is not just under control, but that the Ukrainians have recaptured Kupiansk. He says that there are only 60 Russian troops left in the town, and that the Ukrainians are now busy engaging in mopping up operations to track them all down and to take them prisoner, or perhaps to kill them, or something of that kind. He said that the Russians have made no progress at all in Pokrovsk, and that the situation there in Pokrovsk continues to be very much, almost completely in fact, under Ukraine's control. He put the number of Russian troops inside Pokrovsk at between 250 and 300. He said that the situation in Liman has stabilised, and he did admit that there is a difficult situation north of Pokrovsk, close to the town of Dobropilia, which is close to where the Russians conducted their breakthrough attack in August. He said that the Russians are concentrating large numbers of troops there, apparently in the intention, with the purpose, of exacting some kind of revenge for their defeats and failures across the rest of the battleground. Now, I don't know of a single other commentator, or perhaps I should say reliable commentator, on either side of the battle, be it Russian or Ukrainian, who thinks that there is any reality to this assessment. And of course, in a place like Ukraine, where the country is at war, many people will be trying to keep an eye on what is happening on the battlefronts. They will be accessing the internet to the extent that they can do, which I suspect is substantial. And they will have some knowledge of the fact that the situation in these places, Kupiansk, Pokrovsk, Liman, elsewhere, is not at all as President Zelensky is saying. Now, Mariana Bezuglaya, the Ukrainian dissident MP, who some people still insist is in some way connected to Zelensky and is used by him as some kind of attack dog against the Ukrainian leadership. I have never, military leadership, I have never agreed, by the way, without interpretation. Anyway, she has come out and said, in the strongest terms, that this is all absolute nonsense, that it bears no connection to reality, and she has actually accused Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, of lying about the catastrophic situation on the Ukrainian battlefields. Julian Repka, the journalist, the reporter of Bild Zeitung, a German journalist who is an ardent supporter of Ukraine. He has never been anything less than that. He recently ridiculed an offer that he personally received from Russian media to visit Pokrovsk himself in accordance with Russian President Putin's recent ceasefire offer. Anyway, Julian Repka has said, in flat contradiction to what Zelensky is saying, that the Russians now control around 85% of Pokrovsk. I believe that is true. In fact, I think it may now be significantly more than that. And my own view, to say it straightforwardly, is that the battle of Pokrovsk, if one can call it that anymore, has essentially ended, and that what we're now seeing is a gradual mopping up operation and round up by the Russians of the remaining holdouts inside the Pokrovsk cauldron. But I will come to all of that in more detail shortly. I believe the same is true of Kupiansk. I think that Zelensky's discussions of the situation in Kupiansk is mostly imaginary. There is no doubt that the Ukrainians have indeed carried out a counterattack of some kind in the Kupiansk area, but as we will see shortly, it's clear that it has been unsuccessful. Now, the big question is this: does Zelensky himself believe all this? Does he genuinely believe that the situation is as he is saying? Or is he engaged in some kind of deception operation against the Ukrainian people? Now, the second is very bad, but the first, if possible, is perhaps even worse. Because if Zelensky believes all this nonsense, then he is so completely detached from the realities of the situation on the front lines that, going back to what I said a moment ago, I do wonder whether it is possible for him to remain much longer president of Ukraine. Now, it seems to me that over the last 2 weeks, there has been a change in the political dynamics in Ukraine, in Kiev. Previously, when there were political challenges to President Zelensky, they came from what might be called the liberal end of the Maidan movement, people who were still ardent supporters of Ukraine's struggle with Russia, but who basically looked to the West and looked to the West for support and saw Ukraine's integration with the West. It seems to me that what has begun to happen over the last 2-3 weeks, as the situation on the battlefields has deteriorated, is that the more ultra-nationalist groups, the Azov and Aidar units and their leaders, people like Biletsky and others, they're starting to assert themselves. And I discussed in a program recently about how they, and by they, I suspect one should also include Mariana Bezuglaya, are now advocating for the appointment of General Dropati, as the new military chief of Ukraine. Now, this looks to me an attempt to force Draupadi on Zelensky and perhaps ultimately transfer conduct of the war away from Zelensky to these ultra-nationalist hardliners. In which case, we will see, and this is not unusual in societies which face the kind of military defeat and disaster which we are starting to see play out in Ukraine, we are going to see a significant radicalization in Ukraine itself and probably a distancing from the West. Obviously, whatever Ukrainian government remains in control in Kiev will still have to rely on the West. But I suspect that they will be less keen on things like joining the European Union, for example, than Zelensky himself has been. And of course, this radicalization that I'm talking about may not be widely supported within the wider Ukrainian society. And I can imagine that he could sharpen divisions and sharpen them very considerably over the next few weeks and months. Well, this is all very speculative at the moment. I would say that if there is going to be a challenge for Zelensky, it is going to come from these far-right nationalist groups, not from the more liberal figures who are associated in the West with the Maidan movement and the opposition to Zelensky. This has not yet happened, but I really do wonder whether after these events, the hardline nationalists, who certainly do understand the realities of the situation on the ground, they must be asking themselves whether Zelensky has now become such an extreme liability for Ukraine that he cannot remain the country's president. Because if he is talking in this way, and worse still, if he is thinking in this way, then, as Bezeglaya hinted, he is no longer remotely capable of making proper decisions. Anyway, with that, let's now get on to the actual military situation. But before I do and talk about the situation on the ground, just to say that last night, Russia conducted another major combined missile and drone attack across Ukraine. A particular town that seems to have been targeted is the city, small city, of Pavlograd, which incidentally lies to the west, directly to the west of Pokrovsk. If the Russians capture the motorway, well, of course, they're already occupying the motorway that leads, parts and stretches of the motorway, that lead from the city of Dnipro on the Dnieper River to Pokrovsk. If you take that motorway from Pokrovsk and drive west, you will eventually get to Dnipro, the great city on the Dnieper, but you will pass through the smaller city of Pavlograd first. And if the Russians really do have plans to advance westwards towards the Dnieper from Pokrovsk along this motorway, then obviously they will have to capture Pavlograd. And Pavlograd itself, some say that even though it's fairly big, significantly bigger than Pokrovsk, is difficult to defend. It doesn't have a chain of other towns and dense villages and industrial plants and things of that kind, such as you find in Donbass, which can provide an interlinked fortification system. And there are some claims that the fortifications around Pavlograd are anyway very light and poor. Anyway, Pavlograd nonetheless does act as a logistics hub for the Ukrainians. I mean, it's a place where their troops and their supplies are assembled before they're sent eastwards towards Donbass, and it's played that role throughout the war. And I remember way back in 2022, Alex Vershinin, the US military officer, who has written very astutely about industrial warfare and the extent to which the West has fallen behind China and Russia in industrial warfare, and has spoken very insightfully about the war in Ukraine. Anyway, he spoke about how Pavlograd is a city that the Russians might indeed at some point want to capture. Anyway, I am not going to go and anticipate Russian moves. As I've said previously, it's now absolutely clear to me that the Russians are working to a very careful and carefully thought through battle plan. I've discussed why in previous programs, but I'm not going to try and second guess what that battle plan is. For the record, I still believe that the Russian priority is to roll up the remaining towns in Donbass, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk and Konstantinovka, once Pokrovsk is captured, though doubtless they will turn to Pavlograd eventually, unless there is a peace settlement first. Anyway, let's talk now about the situation on the battlefronts. And Julian Repke, as I said, from Bild Zeitung, now says that the Russians control 85% of Pokrovsk. Now, in fact, we have now received a certain amount of video footage showing the situation in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, and they do give us some insight into what is taking place there. But let's first turn to the Russian Defense Ministry, who are now providing us far more detailed accounts of the progress of the battle than they did earlier in the war. And this is what they say. In Pokrovsk, assault groups of the 2nd and 51st Army continue to neutralize the encircled Ukrainian troops. Russian units have liberated four buildings in the Prigorodny residential sector of the eastern part of the Tsentralny district, Gnatovka and Rog. These are two villages that are located between Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, are being mopped up. 24 buildings have been liberated. This is in the Pokrovsk area. And then the Defense Ministry goes on to say 10 enemy attacks made in order to escape the encirclement were repelled in the north and northwestern directions from Pokrovsk. So these appear to be attempts by Ukrainian troops to break out of Pokrovsk. They were defeated. And then the Defense Ministry says three attempts to unblock the Ukrainian group of foreign mercenaries from Gryshino were thwarted. So that looks like the Russians are now talking about a group of foreign mercenaries, a unit of foreign mercenaries located within the cauldron in Pokrovsk. There was an attempt to enable it to escape, again to Gryshino, the village to the west of Pokrovsk, which remains under Ukrainian control. And the Russian Defense Ministry says that was sorted. And then they go on to say the enemy lost more than 30 men. And then turning to Mirnograd, they say this, that units of the 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade, 51st Army, have liberated a further 17 buildings in northern, eastern and southeastern parts of Mirnograd. and moved towards the Zapadny neighbourhood. The expansion of the control zone and the tightening of the encirclement around the enemy from the east are underway. Up to 205 enemy troops, two pickup trucks and one artillery gun were neutralised. In total, up to 430 troops, Ukrainian troops, a tank, three armoured vehicles, seven motor vehicles, three artillery guns were neutralised in the group of centre, Russian army's group, centre group area of responsibility. Now, we have some video footage that confirms this. There are pictures that show Russian troops moving around Mirnograd, and there are also film pictures that show Russian troops moving around these very same places in northeastern Pokrovsk that the Russian Defense Ministry is talking about. And as a number of people have pointed out, the most interesting fact about this footage is that the Russian soldiers who are shown in this footage seem to be moving about without any fear of attack, and that there is no sign of fighting. Certainly, that appears to be the case in Mirnograd. I get the sense that fighting in Mirnograd has essentially stopped, and that probably explains why the Russians are able to capture a dozen or a score of buildings in Mirnograd at a time. But it also is starting to look to be the same in northeastern Pokrovsk as well. And I ought to quickly say that I suspect that the Russians now have physical control over the fields between Mirnograd and Pokrovsk, south of these two villages that the Defense Ministry were talking about, Gnatovka and Brog. I suspect that the Russians basically control the intervening countryside. So we are now talking about a relatively small cauldron, probably smaller than the one that you see in the various maps that the mapping projects have provided. I say that it's important to stress that the mapping projects are making their assessments based on visually confirmed movements of troops, Russian troops and Ukrainian troops. So they need some visual confirmation or at least some reliable report from someone on the ground before they make adjustments. I, by contrast, since I'm not part of a mapping project, am able to speculate, and I've just speculated. I think, as I said, that the cauldron, which is shrinking anyway, has now shrunk significantly to a much smaller size than before. Now, it's been suggested that Pokrovsk has already essentially fallen, and maybe it has. Maybe the Russians control all the main buildings. It's been suggested that they control the gas works in northeastern Pokrovsk, and indeed we do see the Russian troops moving around the gas works, and there is no sign of fighting there, and that they control an area of high-rise buildings, which appears to be located north of the gas works as well. And again, we don't actually have video footage of the Russians in that area of high-rise buildings, but some people are extrapolating from the movements of Russian soldiers and are assuming that the way in which the Russians are acting suggests that this area of high-rise buildings has also fallen. Maybe it has, but I suspect that the reality is that there continue to be holdouts of Ukrainian troops right across Pokrovsk, and by the way, Mirnograd as well, probably even in southern places in Pokrovsk, and I read an account by the Russian Defense Ministry. Yesterday, we spoke about one specific Russian military unit which is tasked with the particular job of combing through Pokrovsk and tracking down and clearing up these Ukrainian stragglers and mopping up any remaining point of resistance. So maybe Pokrovsk has fallen in the sense that the Ukrainians no longer have any control there, at least control over most, nearly all of the town. But that doesn't mean that the Russians have complete control over Pokrovsk. And we will probably have to wait a couple of days before we can say that and before the Defense Ministry confirms it. In Mirnograd, I suspect it is the same. The reference by the Russian Defense Ministry to attempts by the Ukrainians to break out of the encirclement that the Ukrainians have still made, still continue to make attempts, 10 enemy attacks in order to escape the encirclement were repelled in the north and northwestern directions. That suggests that there are still Ukrainian formations, troops, who retain some kind of organization and some kind of ability to keep fighting. And presumably one must include in this, amongst these units, this group of foreign mercenaries that the Russian Defense Ministry was talking about. But it does seem to me, overall, that the Battle of Pokrovsk, and by the way, of Mirnograd, is now essentially over. We are talking about mopping up operations rather than intense battles. This is still a fairly large territory, and as I said, this process will take several days, but the main battle of Pokrovsk is over. And I would also add something else. There's now been quite a lot of video footage coming out of Pokrovsk and less from Mirnograd, but the interesting thing is that the damage to the city, the town, is significantly less than what we have seen in earlier battles. Certainly, this is not Bakhmut or Avdeyevka or Toretsk, places that have been devastated over the course of the fighting. It looks as if, despite the fact that the Ukrainians assembled a sizable force to defend Pokrovsk, when the battle began, much of that force, in one form or another, melted away or offered light resistance, enabling the Russians to capture the entire town, mostly intact. So anyway, that is the situation in Pokrovsk. There's still places like the Zapadny neighborhood, which the Russian Defense Ministry mentions that the Russians need to capture in Mirnograd and such places. But I think there is no doubt now that we are practically at the end. Anyway, what about Kupiansk? Because, of course, this is where Zelensky claims that the Ukrainians have been tremendously successful. They have recaptured Kupiansk. There's only 60 Russian soldiers left there. It's now just mopping up operations for the Ukrainians to establish or tighten control of Kupiansk. And the Ukrainians in Kupiansk have achieved a famous victory. Now, there is a lot less video footage from Kupiansk than there is from Pokrovsk. Pokrovsk, for obvious reasons, has been attracting a lot more attention. But for the record, this is what the Russian Ministry of Defense is saying about the situation in Kupiansk. In the vicinity of Kupiansk, units of the 6th Army continue to tighten the encirclement around the enemy. The Russian armed forces disrupted a counterattack launched by the 1st National Guard Brigade near Petrovka in order to break through to the Oskol River and pave the way out of the left bank for the surrounded Ukrainian troops. Up to 10 Ukrainian troops and an armoured vehicle were neutralised. So this is, they're talking now about the counterattack that a lot of people spoke about yesterday, and which I touched on yesterday, and which Zelensky was talking about. An attempt by a unit, perhaps no more than a section, around 10 men, of the National Guard, the Ukrainian National Guard, to break through and to reach the Oskol River, not in order to recapture Kupiansk, 10 men can't do that, but in order to capture a crossing point so that the Ukrainian troops trapped on the east bank of the Oskol River could escape. This is not a counterattack in any sense that I would understand, at least based on what the Russian Defense Ministry is saying. This is a raid by a small group of commandos to try to capture a crossing point, and it failed. And apparently, if one reads carefully what the Russian Defense Ministry are saying, all of the people involved appear to have been, as the Russians put it, neutralized. Perhaps that means they were killed. Anyway, that operation appears to have been unsuccessful. And notice that the Russian Defense Ministry again says that the Ukrainian forces on the east bank of the Oskol River remained trapped. And then the Russian Defense Ministry goes on to say, Russian troops go on tightening the encirclement around the enemy from the northeast near Petropavlovka. Over the past 24 hours, the enemy has lost up to 40 troops, 16 units of weaponry and military hardware, including an armoured personnel carrier, a 155mm gun, two armoured fighting vehicles, as well as a US Humvee, two mortars, a lorry, and three pickup trucks close to Kupiansk. This is in the area, presumably, of the encirclement on the east bank. In total, more than 220 troops, enemy troops, five armoured vehicles, 21 motor vehicles, and one field artillery gun have been neutralised in this area. Six electronic warfare stations, a counterfire radar, and six ammunition depots were neutralised. Well, we don't need to waste time speculating about the exact details here about the precise losses that the Russian Defence Ministry are talking about. Overall, the story is clear enough. Kupiansk, according to the Russian Defense Ministry, the Ukrainian troops in Kupiansk continue to be encircled. They remain in a cauldron, and rather like what is happening in Pokrovsk, the Russians are in the process of conducting mopping up operations. Now, I said previously that there is, in contrast to Pokrovsk, no video footage that confirms what the Russian Defense Ministry are saying. And there is altogether less interest in Kupiansk and less information and reporting from there. But consider, we've had reports, claims I should say, from Zelensky about the situation in Pokrovsk that turned out to be completely, fantastically wrong. Why think, therefore, that what he's saying about Kupiansk is true. By contrast, the Russian Defense Ministry's account of what is going on in Pokrovsk has been, to some extent at least, verified by video footage. Why, therefore, assume that their account of what is going on in Kupiansk is false? I just make these points. They're simple ones. It seems to me that more likely than not, we're coming closer to the end point in Kupiansk as well. Though, to say it straightforwardly, I don't have the information to be able to say whether we are as close to the end point in Kupiansk as we are to the end point in Pokrovsk. Now, over the last couple of days, there's been many reports and claims about the Ukrainians trying to make attacks to try to break through to Pokrovsk from the north through Rodinska. And there's been video footage which has undoubtedly confirmed fighting in Rodinska and the presence of Ukrainian troops there. Both Radovka and Marat Khairulin, who I am sure get their information from the Russian military, however, show Rodinska firmly under Russian control in the maps that they are providing. And I don't think it's difficult, again, to work out what has happened. There was another report from a Russian Telegram channel, which I think is probably correct. The Ukrainians did launch attacks trying to break through to the encircled Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk by trying to recapture Rodinska. But what happened is that the Russians, as they often do, stepped aside, let the Ukrainians advance deep into Rodinska, and then they encircled and defeated the entire group. Boris Rozhin, a Russian commentator who writes under the name of Colonel Kassad, and who is, by the way, one of the most interesting and insightful commentators about the war, and who is no fan of President Putin's, by the way, just to quickly say. Anyway, he has said that the topography of Rodinska makes it all but impossible, now that the Russians have captured it, for the Ukrainians to be able to recapture it. This is a doomed enterprise. So there we are. Pokrovsk, perhaps already, to all intents and purposes, fallen, and likely to be declared fallen by the Russians within the next couple of days. At some point in the next couple of days, we know less about the situation in Kupiansk, but I suspect it is very similar. What about the situation in other places? Well, we have had video footage in Zaporozhye region, which shows the Russians now fighting inside the village of Uspenovka, which is located on the west bank of the Yanchur River. It is the only important village on the west bank of the Yanchur River which remains under Ukrainian control. I don't expect that battle to last very long, at which point the Russians will presumably advance eastwards, cut the supply lines to the town, the important town of Guliapolye from the north, and unless the Ukrainian command makes the necessary decision to order the Ukrainian troops who are defending Guliapolye to withdraw, then those troops in Guliapolye are also going to find themselves trapped and in another cauldron. On the other side of the battle lines, in the north, there is now evidence, at least, shall I say, the various mapping and reporting projects and the various reporters on the Russian side, maybe not so much the Ukrainian side, they are now openly saying that there is fighting going on in Siversk itself, that the Russians have indeed broken into Siversk, that they are occupying several streets and buildings in Siversk, and it has been suggested that the Ukrainian counterattack in Yampol a few days ago, which the Ukrainians were saying had recaptured most of Yampol, was mostly intended to provide the Ukrainian garrison in Siversk with an escape route to flee from Siversk. Well, that may be so, but that, of course, depends on what the situation in Yampol now is like. And, well, there is actually a significant distance between Yampol and Siversk. And if the Ukrainians were to withdraw from Siversk, reaching this exit point in Yampol, they would have to cross roads, move along roads, which are now heavily patrolled by the Russian drones. Bear in mind again that it is the season of the Rasputitsa. The fields north and south of these roads are now very muddy, very difficult to escape across. There is constant rain, I believe, in which case, if the Ukrainians are indeed now going to make a quick dash from Siversk and try to escape towards Yampol and beyond Yampol to Slavyansk itself, well, in that case, they're going to have to use the roads. I can't really see how it can be done across the fields, given the distances involved and given the climate and the weather conditions and the condition of the soil. So, looks as if the Battle of Siversk is perhaps not quite finished, but we have probably a few weeks, maybe 1 or 2 weeks left. These are just guesses on my part. Siversk is not a big place. It's been difficult for the Russians to reach because it is on a hill, and there have been water obstacles and smaller villages around Siversk, which the Russians have had to capture before they could reach Siversk itself. But now it seems universally accepted that the Russians have reached Siversk and have broken into the town. And as I said, it's a town of about 10,000 people before the war, a very small place and a relatively small place. In other words, I cannot imagine that it can be defended by the Ukrainians for very long. Anyway, that seems to me the overall situation on the battlefronts. Zelensky, even if he knows that the situation is not as he is describing, the very fact that he is talking in this extraordinary way is going to create huge question marks about him. And of course, there will be more and more people when confirmation of the fall of Pokrovsk and Kupiansk and Siversk and Liman as well, no doubt, when it all comes, they will all be asking, what was Zelensky doing? Why was he giving us such a completely false account of the state of the battle? Now, there are a large number of reports circulating on the Ukrainian internet that General Sirski's days are now indeed numbered, that his failure to reverse the situation in Pokrovsk has basically ended his career. And, well, one can imagine that Zelensky will blame Sirski for misleading him about the state of the battle. And quite plausibly, this is indeed the case. But bear in mind again that Sirski is one individual, the person who is the overall commander-in-chief is Zelensky himself. He doesn't need to just rely on Sirski to get an accurate idea of the information, of the situation on the battle lines. Putin, Sirski's great adversary and opponent, constantly and at random telephones commanders of individual units at various places on the battlefronts. Sometimes, apparently, these can be very junior officers. And, well, partly he's doing that, no doubt, in order to provide encouragement. But the main reason he does it, of course, is in order to make sure that he's getting an accurate picture of what the situation on the front lines actually is. He's talking to the men who are right there on at the actual edge of the battle. And there is nothing to prevent Zelensky doing the same thing. Perhaps he does, in which case, of course, he must be lying. Perhaps he doesn't, in which case, all I would say is he seems to be making a deliberate choice to shut himself off from bad news. Now, I've discussed the military situation. Yesterday, in my program, I also touched on the financial situation. The fact that Ukraine is now in a very grim financial situation indeed. Even Zelensky is admitting this. He says that Ukraine has run out of money to restock its reserves of natural gas, and more money from the West is needed to do that. And it's now widely expected, anticipated, by the way, that there's going to be a very, very cold winter in Ukraine and in Central and Eastern Europe, and colder than the winters we have had previously in the war. And of course, as I've discussed in several programs now, the situation with the Ukrainian energy system is much worse than it has been in any earlier winter. And the reason for that is because the Russian attacks on that energy system have been much more intense. But, of course, it goes beyond that, because it's been obvious for some time now that Ukrainian industry has essentially stopped functioning, and the Ukrainian agricultural system does function, but it must be under extreme pressure as the war intensifies, and that Ukraine has become essentially or mostly a service economy. What industrial activity still takes place is entirely connected to the war. Workshops, for example, scattered across Ukraine, trying to put drones together. Zelensky's attempt to get his Flamingo missile operating has been unsuccessful, at least so far, precisely for the reasons that I've discussed. And anyway, as I also discussed in my program yesterday, Ukraine's defense budget is ballooning. And I've touched on in yesterday's program on some of the reasons, probably an explosion of corruption and things of that kind. And, well, Ukraine is now spending, its budget is spending, as I've heard some suggest, more than its total GDP, such as it is its actual GDP. And, of course, its debt levels have been increasing. Its debt to GDP level is above 100%. And of course, there's also probably an enormous pile-up of private debt in the economy about which we have less and less information. Anyway, the European Commission is apparently now going around European governments and telling them that the situation in Ukraine is now so critical that unless the European Union authorizes what the European Commission still refers to as a reparation loan, that is to say, a loan sent to Ukraine by the European Union, the amount is 140 billion euros, drawn in some complex, unexplained way on the Russian stolen assets or frozen assets, let's call them frozen assets. Then the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is going to have to halt its lending program to Ukraine, and presumably the World Bank will have to do the same, at which point Ukraine will in effect be cut off from all funds. It will have gone not just from the kind of default situation in which it is already in, but in a situation where any further flow of funds from the West to Ukraine becomes probably legally impossible. Well, in that event, the only way that the Ukrainian government would be able to keep meeting its payments is by printing money. I've discussed this whole situation before in the past. Ukraine has come at on several occasions after the 2014 crisis, very close to this point. It did so, I remember, in the winter of 2014, 2015. And, well, of course, it's also come close to this point at several moments during the war, the current war, the one which began in February 2022. So we have a situation where Ukraine, where there is no output, no physical output, or shall we say, where physical output of the economy is significantly reduced, is going to have to start printing money to pay for the war and to pay for other activities. And there's also been a massive exodus of young people from Ukraine. Now, in a decision which very few people can understand, and which in Ukraine itself is being cited as another example of how President Zelensky has begun to lose touch with realities. A few months ago, President Zelensky lifted the travel ban on young people that had been imposed in Ukraine at the very start of the conflict. So young people, young men in their late teens and 20s, who up to now have not been able to leave Ukraine, have been flooding out. There's reports of an exodus of 100,000 such young men over the last 3 months, 1,000 a day leaving Ukraine, with no intention in most cases of ever going back, and obviously very worried that if they did go back, at some point the Ukrainian military would want to enlist them. When this happened, I gave Zelensky the benefit of the doubt, and I said that I hope that it was a humane action on his part to keep these young people out of the horror of the war by letting them go free. And I'm going to cling to that belief, though there's little evidence in other respects that President Zelensky acts from humanitarian considerations very much. But of course, within the Ukrainian military, and within that part of Ukrainian society that want to continue the war, well, they have an altogether different view. They think it was a crazy decision, and further proof, as I said, that Zelensky himself is losing touch with reality. But of course, the point is that 100,000 young men leaving Ukraine over the space of 3 months, 1,000, an exodus of 1,000 a day, is going to further limit and reduce economic activity. There's no clear idea of how many people there still are in Ukraine. I've seen some claims that the population has now fallen to below 20 million. It was over 50 million at the time when when Ukraine seceded from the Soviet Union, obtained its independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. But anyway, the point is that in a situation where there are fewer and fewer people, and I remember a Hungarian deputy foreign minister telling the group that I was in during my trip to Budapest last year, that it is an eerie experience travelling around Ukraine, that the moment you leave the cities, you find a countryside that has been almost entirely emptied of people. Anyway, all of this, an absence of people, a collapsed industry, an agriculture that is still perhaps just about ticking along, and a service sector that functions in a few cities. Well, all of this is a recipe, if external funding is cut off, for hyperinflation. It's difficult to imagine that Ukraine would avoid a hyperinflation crisis if the external funding came to a stop, as presumably it would if the IMF pulled out of its lending program to Ukraine, and if the European Union and the United States were unable to provide Ukraine with further financial support. Now, we have to be careful here, because the European Commission is clearly floating this possibility in order to panic European governments into agreeing to the loan idea, the reparations loan idea, proposed by Ursula von der Leyen and Friedrich Merz. It's now become clear that opposition to this loan has gone beyond Belgium, that France and Italy oppose it also. So there is a significant amount of opposition to this whole loan idea in the European Council. But again, the very fact that people are talking in this way perhaps emphasizes or re-emphasizes the sense of crisis that exists in Ukraine now, and which also exists amongst Ukraine's backers. Now, here perhaps I will just quickly say something about the IMF. As far as I'm concerned, Ukraine defaulted on its loans back in 2014. The previous Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, had taken out a loan with Russia, $3 billion loan, as I remember, drawn on Russia's sovereign wealth fund. It was a loan taken out in basically Irish bonds, as I remember, guaranteed or supposedly guaranteed in the London financial markets. As soon as the Maidan coup took place, Ukraine refused to pay the loan. The Russians took legal action to get the loan paid in the High Court in London. The judge at first instance, Mr. Justice Blair, the brother of the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, found, as I assumed he would, in favour of Russia. But the Court of Appeal overrode his decision, citing arguments which I will say straightforwardly, I don't understand. Anyway, there was then supposed to be a further appeal to the British Supreme Court, but if such an appeal has ever happened, I've heard nothing about it. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that was a default, and the IMF should have stopped its lending programme to Ukraine at that time. Pressing on with its lending programme to a country that is in default of its loans is contrary to the IMF's charter and rules. The IMF paid no heed. Christine Lagarde, who was at that time the IMF's head, just acted as if this whole default had never happened. And the IMF, despite bitter argument within its board, just went on lending to Ukraine and have continued to lend to Ukraine and to support Ukraine throughout every stage of the crisis since then. Inevitably, that has caused further divisions within the IMF itself. And if there is any truth at all to this story that it is now on the brink of reconsidering its further lending program to Ukraine, well, I'm going to suggest that Christine Lagarde, who of course now heads the European Central Bank, and other IMF officials who acted in the way that they did and who have as a result lost the IMF a huge amount of money, should be sent held to account for what they have done. I doubt, of course, they will. More likely, they will all be promoted to some other position. That is the iron rule in the West today. But anyway, I wanted to say that. That is what I wanted to say about this. So, Zelensky must be aware of all of this. You must be aware that there is at least a possibility that in 6 months' time, Ukraine could be facing a hyperinflation situation. Ukraine does have some capable technocrats, and they're no doubt explaining all of this to him. The big unanswered question for me is, what does he really know about the situation on the battlefronts, and what will he do when he finds out? Well, one thing he perhaps will do is sack Sirski, and no doubt he will blame Sirski for misleading him, but I've already discussed that and how, as far as I'm concerned, that is a completely unconvincing defence. Anyway, on the other side, on the Russian BRICS side, the situation again looks profoundly different. Now, I've said in recent programmes that there has been very strong delegations from Russia, one headed by the Russian Prime Minister, Mikhail Mishustin, and the other headed by the Russian Deputy Prime Minister in overall charge of the economy, Denis Manturov. They have both been in China. Now, I assumed that Manturov and Mishustin would come together and they would both join up for the meeting which took place yesterday with Xi Jinping. It seems that Manturov actually completed his business and has returned to Moscow. But nonetheless, Mishustin did go ahead and did indeed meet with Xi Jinping. And he brought a large part of the Russian government with him. So amongst the people who participated in this meeting were the Russian finance minister, Anton Siluanov, and the Russian economics minister, Maxim Reshetnikov, and all sorts of other Russian officials. And Mishustin, when he met with Xi Jinping, had all of these people with him, and Xi Jinping had much of the Chinese government with him as well. Bear in mind that before the meeting between Mishustin and Xi Jinping, Mishustin also had a meeting with the Chinese Prime Minister Li Qiang. And Li Qiang has subsequently made comments. He said that China and Russia are now going to take steps to coordinate and harmonize their economic development strategies. They're going to dovetail them. And, well, in contrast to the rather icy readout that the Chinese Foreign Ministry provided of the meeting between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump a week ago, the readout of Xi Jinping's meeting with Mishustin, as I said, each acting as heads of delegations with all sorts of officials involved. Readout from the Chinese Foreign Ministry of this meeting has been much more detailed and much more effusive. I would also add that the meeting took place in the Great Hall of the People. This is the usual place where Chinese leaders meet foreign dignitaries. But sometimes the Chinese leadership meets lower-ranking officials at Diaoyutai, the state guest house, but this meeting took place in the Great Hall of the People. And Mishustin, interestingly, was provided with a guard of honor from the Chinese army on his arrival. And then the Chinese Foreign Ministry's readout makes comments like this. President Xi pointed out that anchored to the goal of higher level and higher quality development, Chinese-Russia relations have forged ahead this year, despite the turbulent external environment. It is our shared strategic choice to uphold, consolidate, and develop China-Russia relations. And he talks about his very good relationship with President Putin. And he says that the two sides must maintain close coordination and effectively implement the important consensus President Putin and I have reached. And then he goes on to say that both sides should steadily expand mutual investment, carry out effective cooperation in traditional areas such as energy. So obviously China's going to continue buying Russian oil, and Power of Siberia 2 is going ahead. Connectivity, agriculture, aviation and aerospace, tap potential in artificial intelligence, digital economy, green development and other new areas to create new growth areas for cooperation. Intensify people-to-people exchanges, engaging wider sections of the two societies in joint pursuit of friendship and cooperation. And then he talked about the China's 15th five-year plan and how China is advancing modernization on all fronts, and China stands ready to work with Russia to pursue greater synergy between China's 15th five-year plan and Russia's economic and social development strategies for the continued benefit of the two peoples. So in effect, the two economies, the Chinese and Russian economies, are integrating. They're dovetailing with each other. Now, many people will say, and do say, that Russia is, as a result, in the process of becoming a Chinese economic province, a greater China. I don't happen to agree, but regardless, is that an outcome that we in the West should welcome, given that it is going full steam ahead? And for the record, the Russians have just outlined a strategy today for rare earth mining on their territory and for the expansion of refining technology, rare earth refining technology in Russia. And one can see that this is going to dovetail with what the Chinese are doing, and it cuts against the relationship between the prospective economic relationship between Russia and the United States that President Trump seemed so keen to develop. Now, other things are also happening in the wider economic world. A couple of days ago, I read an article in the Daily Telegraph by its commentator, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, talking about how Russia was being undermined by the great glut in oil supplies, the excessive extra output in oil supplies, and that had been organized by OPEC. And there have been all sorts of claims that this has been engineered by President Trump using his supposed close relations with Saudi Arabia's de facto leader, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and Prime Minister, by the way, MBS. Well, what has now happened is that Saudi Arabia and OPEC are slamming the brakes on oil production. They have become worried about the supply glut and about the fall in oil supplies, or so they say, and for that reason they're engaging in a program of oil production reduction. Now, there are reasons for this which have absolutely nothing to do with the Russians, and it's not intended to help with the Russians. Saudi Arabia is running a major budget deficit, apparently around 5% of GDP. And Saudi Arabia, of course, has a massive and massively ambitious economic development strategy, not all parts of which are going well by any means. And MBS needs to keep the money flowing into Saudi Arabia to maintain stability there. So he needs a higher oil price rather than a lower one. And here, I would simply make the point, he's in a weaker position than Putin and Russia, who have a much more diversified economy and a far bigger economy than Saudi Arabia does. So MBS has a reason to slam on the brakes, and he's probably doing that for straightforward economic reasons relating to Saudi Arabia's own domestic needs. But again, I suspect that there is something else at play here too. And this is that, again, the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, which the United States imposed 10 days ago, are clearly intended to shape the oil market. Now, that is something, and I've discussed this in many programs, that the Saudis are not going to be happy with. Because as far as they are concerned, shaping the direction of the oil market, deciding where it's going, whether there's going to be a glut or a shortage, whether the price is going to be pushed up or whether it is going to be pushed down, that is their business, not America's. Oil is what Saudi Arabia depends on. And they will not be happy at the way in which the United States and the European Union have been trying to control the oil market over the last 4 years for geopolitical reasons, in order to try to put pressure on the Russians, as they suppose. So I'm not saying that this explains OPEC's decision to reduce production, but it's something that people perhaps do need to take into account and think about when they glibly assume that it is for the Europeans and the Americans to pull the switch, or the lever if you prefer, and to try to control Russia's energy exports and its receipts from them. For the record, India appears to have increased its imports of oil from Russia this October, which has just passed. Some assume that India is going to start reducing its imports of oil from Russia after the 21st of November, when the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft come into force. But the Indian Oil Corporation, the state-owned one, has already made purchases, future purchases of Indian oil in December. And of course, after the 21st of November, Putin is coming to India, and I expect that they will be discussing energy also. Notice again that Xi Jinping talked about energy cooperation between China and Russia continuing. And for the record, China's consumption of oil remains so vast that it can quite comfortably absorb all the production that Russia makes. Anyway, let's just finish this program by turning to one of the few remaining voices of sanity that we still find, in this case in Britain. Lord Skidelsky participated in another debate in the House of Lords about the situation in Ukraine. I have been privileged to have been provided with a written version of his comments, which as always strike me as insightful and wise. I have not, however, obtained a complete sense of the entire discussion, though it does look as if the mood in the House of Lords, in the British Parliament, has turned much bleaker about the situation in Ukraine. And it looks as if one particular member of the House of Lords, Lord Tugendhat, apparently acknowledged the possibility of a Ukrainian defeat and a Russian victory, which would be a new thing, especially coming from him. Now, Lord Skidelsky absolutely rightly says, given that this is not an outcome which presumably Britain wants, a Russian victory and a Ukrainian defeat, with all the enormous problems that that will bring in its wake, at least for Britain, surely the right thing to do, again, is to try to find some diplomatic way out of this crisis. And he's absolutely right. And he also showed, shall we say, less enthusiasm for the various proposals that continue to be made to ramp up the sanctions against Russia and to send ever more numbers of advanced weapons to Ukraine. As he rightly points out, this has been repeatedly done, and it has never achieved the objective that its advocates claim. And I noticed that one of the things that he proposed, and it is a view that I absolutely endorse, he said that the British government needs to start talking to the Russians again. We continue to have diplomatic relations with Russia. We have an embassy in Moscow. They have an embassy in London. It should be possible to arrange for the British Foreign Secretary to fly to Moscow to meet Lavrov. Or if that isn't acceptable, maybe, given that Lavrov is unlikely to want to come to London, a meeting can be arranged in some third country. Soon there will be a G20 meeting in South Africa. It's far from certain that Putin himself is going to go, but there will be a Russian presence there. Maybe the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, could meet a whatever Russian official, quite possibly Lavrov, attends the G20 meeting instead. Surely, given that we are looking at a defeat in Ukraine, and I say we, because we are now so over-invested in this enterprise that it will be impossible to pretend that a Ukrainian defeat is not a defeat for Britain. After all, I think it was Donald Tusk, the Prime Minister of Poland, who recently said that a defeat of Ukraine is a defeat for Europe. So a defeat for Ukraine, by extension, must also be a defeat for Britain too. So surely we ought to be straining every nerve, looking for every route to try to find a way out. Now, I don't know what others who listened to Lord Skidelsky's comments think, whether anybody was at all receptive, but I get the impression that overall, in this debate, nobody was. There is a particular English hymn. When I say it's English, the actual author of the words was an American Quaker, or at least not a Quaker, but at least an American abolitionist. There is a particular hymn of which I'm not going to pretend I am particularly, especially fond. And it refers to the still small voice of calm in Britain over the last 4 years. That still small voice of calm has been Lord Skidelsky. This is what I'm going to finish today's programme. Obviously, lots of other things going on in the world, but I'll try and come back to those in my next program. In the meantime, let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on Locals, on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. And also, please remember to check out our new Substack page. Last but not least, if you've liked this program, please remember also to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. And of course, if you've liked this program and liked this channel, then don't forget also to check out our shop. That's me for today. More from me soon.